Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's to be done for a diseased or damaged brain? And how do injuries within the brain lead to loss of function? In the past, scientists paid almost exclusive attention to the workings of neurons, the cells that communicate through rapid-fire electrical pulses across synapses. To be sure, those exchanges are critical to a healthy brain, but just 1 in 10 brain cells is a neuron. To study neurons only leaves out the 85% of the brain made up of glial cells, which were dismissed for a long time by scientists as serving a secondary function, but may in fact hold the key to understanding how the brain works, how it succumbs to injury and disease, and how it might be coaxed to heal itself. R. Douglas Fields is chief of the Section on Nervous System Development at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. His new book is called The Other Brain, From Dementia to Schizophrenia, How New Discoveries About the Brain Are Revolutionizing Medicine and Science. Doug, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Delighted.
Even the word glia sort of speaks to the fact that for a long time, nobody really knew what these were and what they might do for us. Can you talk about that?
That's right. These cells called glia, the word means glue, and they were dismissed for 100 years, largely overlooked, because they were thought to be something like packing material or support structures for neurons.
Mm-hmm. And how do glial cells differ from neurons?
Well, they differ in many ways. Glial cells do not generate electrical impulses. They don't communicate the way neurons do, so they don't have structures like synapses and axons, the wire-like processes for sending signals long distances. Glia are entirely different, and they were understood to be very important in disease and to be housekeeping cells, to take care of the needs of neurons, to provide them with nourishment and to clean up after neurons, remove neurotransmitters and that sort of thing. And it wasn't until recently that people realized that all of those servant-type functions really places glia in a position of control.
When you say that they have the housekeeping function, essentially they make it possible for neurons to fire cleanly and rapidly.
That's right. They maintain the environment around neurons, which is necessary for them to generate electricity. They provide the nutrients, the glucose and lactic acid that neurons need to maintain their energy stores, and they control neurotransmitters that neurons use to communicate with one another across synapses. But the big surprise that was overlooked is that in recent years, scientists found that glia can communicate with each other, but they don't communicate using electricity.
They use chemicals.
They use chemicals. Mm-hmm. And so this is entirely different. All of our thinking about the brain on a fundamental level of how it works really hasn't changed in 100 years. And that's called the neuron doctrine. And we just assumed that all information and information processing and communication in the brain takes place between neurons in neural circuits across synapses by electrical activity. And we now know that fundamental assumption is wrong. So glia communicate by chemical signals with each other.
And in defense of generations of scientists who came before you, it was very hard to observe those transmissions without really modern technology.
Well, that's right. One of the reasons that glial cells were largely overlooked is that we used the wrong tools to study them. And I'm a neuroscientist, and I use those tools in my lab, primarily microelectrodes. So we insert electrodes into the brain to monitor the electrical signals generated by neurons. And essentially, those methods are deaf to the communications that glia are involved in because glia don't use electricity.
Another thing that makes glia different from neurons is that they can divide.
Well, that's right. Glia can divide, and neurons can't. So that makes glia very important in many aspects of disease, everything from cancer to recovery after injury.
How are they like stem cells?
Well, mature neurons can't divide, and stem cells are, of course, the type of cell from early embryo that has the potential to develop into any number of types of cells in the body. Those are stem cells, embryonic stem cells, but in recent years we found that in the adult brain, there are cells that have multipotent stem cell-like properties throughout the brain, and these are glial cells that can be forced or can be translated, differentiated into neurons as well as other types of brain cells. So they're very important in repair and responses to the environment.
So new neurons essentially can be birthed from these glial stem cells.
That's right, because neurons are not dividing. They can't make more neurons. So when a neuron's lost, it's lost forever. And new neurons, if they're born, are not going to be born from neurons. They have to be born from a cell that is not a neuron, and those are glial cells.
So there are four different kinds of glia, about half of which are called astrocytes. What do they do?
That's right. Well, the astrocytes are the cells that I was referring to earlier that are like the packing material, and they are surrounding neurons in the brain, tightly surrounding them, especially synapses. They're called astrocytes because they looked like star-shaped cells with early stains that were used by early anatomists. And they perform these functions that I mentioned of removing neurotransmitter. And these cells can communicate with chemical signals. And you mentioned that new techniques were required, and that's right. The new technique that was developed was an imaging technique that allowed us to see signals, ions, flowing in living cells. And these calcium ions were seen flowing through these glial cells. So they communicate with each other, but they do two other things that was recently discovered. That is that astrocytes monitor neurons. Because if you can imagine these astrocytes surrounding a synapse, and you've seen synapses, all your listeners know from commercials and from school what a synapse looks like, but they always leave out the astrocyte. It's completely surrounding this area, and it picks up the neurotransmitter. This allows the astrocytes to monitor neural activity. And the third thing that they can do is to release neurotransmitters to control synaptic communication between neurons. So astrocytes communicate among themselves, they sense and monitor neural activity, and then they can control the transmission of impulses between neurons. They can control neurons.
What does that control allow them to do? Why is that a positive thing?
Well, it involves them in any aspect of plasticity, which is the strength of a signal from one neuron to another. That's essentially the basis of learning. When a connection between two neurons is strengthened, that's the basis for learning. So this involves astrocytes, one type of glial cell, in the learning process. It also involves glial cells in any sort of neurological or psychological process that would involve synaptic transmission. And so many of the diseases that we're familiar with, neurological diseases, are diseases of synaptic transmission. And most of our drugs that are used to treat neurological disorders, like Parkinson's disease, for example, do so by regulating neurotransmitters. But that's the job of astrocytes. That's what they're normally doing.
And it turns out that astrocytes and taking good care of them is really critical when someone comes into a hospital with a stroke.
Yes, in many ways. The astrocytes respond to injury, but astrocytes also do something that wasn't really understood before, and that is they can control the local blood flow. You know, I think you've probably seen these brain imaging pictures where activity in a certain part of the brain is shown in a color, and this allows us to see which part of the brain is involved in some function, you know?
Sure, it's lighting up because something's going on in the brain.
Right. Mm-hmm. What I think most people don't realize is what's lighting up there is blood flow. It's not really, the MRI machine is not detecting neural activity, it's detecting local blood flow to feed those neurons that are active. It turns out astrocytes are controlling the local blood flow by monitoring neural activity and releasing chemicals to control the flow of blood. So this involves them in responses to stroke and in regulating blood flow in the brain.
What are microglia?
Well, microglia are the immune cells of the brain. So unlike every other tissue in the body, the brain is completely isolated from the immune system. And that's because the fluids in the brain are very special. It's not the same as our blood. And that's necessary in order to allow neural activity to be generated. And it's very sensitive. So the brain fluids are separated from the fluids in the blood. And, of course, our white blood cells are in the blood. That means that the brain has its own immune system, and this system is formed of cells, type of glial cell called microglia. and they seek out infection, foreign proteins, and damage, and they destroy these disease-causing agents in the brain. So microglia are central to nearly every aspect of nervous system disease.
My guest this hour is R. Douglas Fields. He is chief of the Section on Nervous System Development at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. We're talking this hour about his new book, The Other Brain. Let's go next. I want to talk about oligodendrocytes. Can you talk about what they do for us?
Yeah, that's a mouthful. Yes. Well, I think most people are familiar with multiple sclerosis, and that is a disease that is involving the loss of insulation on the axons. The axons are the wire-like processes from neurons that send impulses.
So this is a little myelin sheath.
It's a myelin sheath. So that myelin sheath is electrical insulation. Well, it's formed by a type of glial cell called an oligodendrocyte. And it actually looks like an octopus and has maybe 20 arms that will reach out and find these fibers and begin wrapping around this insulation material, much like electrical tape. It'll wrap up to 150 layers around these axons, and that's absolutely essential for impulse propagation. What it does is speed the flow of transmission impulses 100 times. So oligodendrocytes don't exist in animals without backbones, and that's one of the reasons that lower animals like slugs and snails and that sort of thing don't have high-speed motor abilities. And it's also the reason that we have this higher-level cognition that we see in primates, because by being able to have higher-speed impulse conduction, that allowed the brain to miniaturize, and this gave us the ability to have more powerful brains in smaller area.
And as this myelin continues to wrap around these connections, we're able to sort of learn things and perfect our skills.
Well, that's a new aspect of neuroscience that's come about as a result of looking at glia. In the past, scientists understood what myelin did. They understood that it was insulation and it was very important in disease. But the other shoe never dropped. I mean, we realized that somebody with multiple sclerosis loses his ability to walk or see. And that was understood, the insulation phrase, and transmission breaks down. But no one ever thought of the fact that that would allow myelin to be involved, perhaps, in regulating normal function in the brain. So rather than completely destroying the myelin, what if myelin was able to be modified, and in that way modify impulse conduction through the brain? And very recent research has shown that oligodendrocytes can sense neural activity flowing through nerve axons and respond by forming more myelin. And that will, in turn, change the rate at which transmission is propagated through the brain, and that will improve the performance. So this is, you know, in the past, all learning in the brain has been based on synapses, and that's still, you know, very important and fundamentally true, the idea that neurons that fire together, wire together, become strengthened. But now we're talking about a form of learning that doesn't involve synapses. It involves increasing the speed of impulse transmission through the network of the brain. If I can give you an example, there's been recent papers where they...
Let me have you stop right there. I do want the example, but we need to take a quick
break.
My guest is R. Douglas Fields. He's chief of the Section on Nervous System Development at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. His new book is called The Other Brain, From Dementia to Schizophrenia, How New Discoveries About the Brain Are Revolutionizing Medicine and Science. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment and welcome you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Music. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. R. Douglas Fields is my guest. His new book is called The Other Brain, From Dementia to Schizophrenia, How New Discoveries About the Brain Are Revolutionizing Medicine and Science. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Doug, you promised us an example of how glia contribute to learning by sort of speeding up brain communication.
Right. Well, new brain imaging methods allow us to look in the brain and see changes, structural changes in the brain in ways that we could never do before. And there are two examples I'd like to give. One is brain imaging, looking at a part of the brain can gauge a person's IQ. And the part of the brain that's being looked at is called white matter. And this is the area of the brain under the cortex, which is composed of bundles of fibers that we were talking about that connect different parts of the brain together. And the more organized this area is, then the higher the IQ. So this led to questions about how could insulation on wires have anything to do with thought. And in a very recent series of studies has shown that comparing the brains of people before and after they learn a task, for example, learning to juggle, structural changes are found in the brain, but they're not, they're seen in these areas, white matter regions of the brain, which are these myelinated fibers.
You open the book with a wonderful story of perhaps the most famous brain in human history, that of Albert Einstein.
Right. Well, Einstein's brain was stolen at autopsy and by the pathologist and hidden away for 40 years. And during that time, the pathologist doled out pieces of it to pseudoscientists and scientists throughout the world to probe it for his genius. And part of it finally reached a reputable neuroscientist, Marion Diamond at UC Berkeley. She's a neuroanatomist. And she examined the part of the cortex that's involved in association, higher-level cognitive function, and looked at it under a microscope carefully to see if the neurons were any different in Einstein's brain, were there more neurons, or what could explain his genius. And she could find no difference in the neurons, but she found that he had more glia than the average person, a significantly increased number of glia. Now, that's just an observation of one. Science is hard to know what to do with that, but it forced people to begin to think of what these cells might be doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email to think@kera.org from Gary, who says, over the years, we hear about new discoveries on the cusp of using brain chemicals to cure various addictions, yet nothing ever seems to pan out. Why is the brain chemistry answer to addiction so elusive?
That's a good question. Well, one of the main reasons is the ideas, the fundamental assumptions were that addiction had to do entirely with neurons, a problem with neurons. So I'll give you an example, and that is morphine addiction, or addiction to painkillers. What we now understand is that, and only in the last couple of years, this involves glia. So the dependence that develops from chronic use of these painkillers or heroin or morphine has fundamentally due to glia and the role of what glia normally do in the brain, and that is to modulate activity. So people are typically given morphine to control pain. That dampens neural activity in pain circuits. The glia sense that drop in activity because they also have receptors to sense morphine and also to sense electrical activity. So they release substances that stimulate neurons, and this brings back what would be a normal balance of activity in the system. But that, in effect, is undermining the effect of morphine. So this now requires that more morphine be given to increase the effect. And so you have this ratcheting up of more and more morphine needed to have the same effect because glia are antagonizing that. And when morphine is suddenly withdrawn, then that releases the brakes suddenly provided by that drug and causes excruciating pain. People with going cold turkey off of heroin find normal sensations very painful. And so part of the reason for difficulty in understanding addiction is that we were only looking at the neurons and we weren't considering the other brain.
What role do glia play in people who suffer from chronic pain that is no longer tied to any kind of acute injury?
Well, that that's a good example of what we're talking about, the importance of the other brain and overlooking the other brain, because chronic pain is a different kind of pain from acute pain that obviously is very important, saves us from burning our hand on the stove and that sort of thing. But as you say, chronic pain is different, and this is a pain that develops after an injury heals. A back injury gets better, but these people suffer excruciating pain and never gets any better. And the only recourse doctors have had is to give morphine, because the basis for this pain really isn't understood. There's no longer any damage. Again, just in the last few years, scientists have discovered that the reason for that is that we've overlooked glia. And glia are responding to the initial injury, astrocytes and microglia. And they're important in the initial repair process. They release substances that actually stimulate neurons. And you know, after you have an injury, you're hypersensitive, and that's really helpful. If you get an injury, your finger, for example, it becomes very tender even around the injury site, because substances are released that excite pain neurons, and that helps you heal. It makes you leave that thing alone so it'll get better. So glia are releasing these substances. They're very important in the initial stages of recovery, but if they don't stop releasing those substances, then the pain never goes away. And so the chronic pain is developing not necessarily as a result of anything wrong with the pain neurons. It's a result of glia becoming dysfunctional and releasing these excitatory substances like cytokines. And these substances are being identified, and there are many new treatments that are being developed now to reduce chronic pain that don't involve opiates by targeting glia.
Yeah, there's sort of a related question here via email from Curtis in Arlington, who wants to know, could interfering with oligodendrocytes along pain pathways be used to alleviate chronic pain? And I guess my follow-up question is, how would you do that?
Well, in theory, that would alleviate pain. I mean, some people suffer pain so severely that they have their pain fibers cut. And interestingly, that doesn't always relieve the pain, because the origin of the pain may be deep in the spinal cord where these glia are releasing these excitatory substances. But that's an interesting theoretical way to exploit the role of myelin-forming glia in controlling information processing, because if there is no insulation on those fibers, communication will stop. As you know, there's a lot of surgery done to sever fibers in the brain to restore function, relieve from neurological diseases or even psychiatric diseases, the prefrontal lobotomy, for example. You wouldn't need to cut those fibers. If you could just inhibit the myelination, you could selectively control which pathways are going to conduct and which are not, and in a way rewire the brain. So that's all, you know, theoretical, some ideas for the future. And how you would do that at this point, it would all be speculation, but there are many ways that you could target toxic materials to certain cells, to glial cells, to do that, in theory.
Talk for a minute about how glia serve us in restoring the connection between damaged nerves and muscles.
Well, there's this peculiar difference between a damaged nerve in your trunk or limbs and in the spinal cord. If you damage a nerve in your peripheral nervous system, it'll heal. I've had that. I had a pinched nerve and eventually got better in my neck. But if you damage a fiber in your spinal cord, you'll be permanently paralyzed. And it's long been a mystery as to why that should be. Why is the same injury permanent in leading to spinal cord leading to paralysis when it's a spinal cord injury? Well, it turns out that the glial cells are the reason for paralysis. And the glial cells are important in releasing growth factors. They're important in building the scars and in repairing the early events in nerve regeneration in the spinal cord. But we've also found recently that glia block the efforts of neurons in the spinal cord to reconnect. And they do that because there are proteins in the myelin sheath that we were just talking about that actually stop the new sprouts from growing. So a neuron will form a new sprout if it survives and try to reconnect, but the minute it touches myelin, it collapses and stops growing, and so you're permanently paralyzed.
Is there some protective function to that, or is it just sort of a weird trick of the way that we're wired?
Well, that's a big mystery. It doesn't make any sense. Why did nature booby-trap myelin to stop sprouting? Two things I want to say about that. First of all, this is being exploited. This new information is being exploited right now in clinical trials because these inhibitory proteins have been identified, and if we interfere with them then in experimental animals, paralysis can be overcome and sprouting can resume. And this is being done now in people, and it's looking very, very promising. But it still leaves you the question, why did nature do that? And the recent realization is that sprouting is not always good. And there's kind of a mystery here about myelin. Myelin forming, myelin, this insulation, begins to form in the embryo, but it continues to form clear through to our 20s. And we've known this for 100 years. But why, if it's just insulation, why isn't myelination done by the time we're born? Instead, we see this myelin taking place throughout the brain through adolescence, the same period that we know our brain is being modified by the environment to make your brain different from my brain to be ideally suited to the environment that we were reared in. And so the idea is we know that there are these critical periods for learning. You know, if you learn a foreign language after puberty, you're going to speak it with an accent. But if you learn it before puberty, you won't. There are certain critical periods, and different types of knowledge have different windows in which you can learn them. And the thought now is that the sprouting and rewiring of synapses is important through the critical period, but once these circuits are established, then they become myelinated, and that stops the sprouting, and this blocks further sprouting and modification in those circuits. So, for example, all babies are born with the ability to understand any sound in any language, but like R and L sound in Japanese, an adult Japanese person who never hears that sound in adolescence loses the ability to distinguish those sounds because it loses that wiring. Those sounds don't exist in Japanese, so why have circuits to distinguish them? And the answer is you don't. You lose those circuits. But once you attain this skill, whatever the skill is, language or your profession, you wouldn't want to lose it. You wouldn't want it to unwire, unwrap. And so that's now what we think is a very important aspect of myelin.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is R. Douglas Fields, whose new book is called The Other Brain. Let's go on the phone to Melody in Lancaster. Hi, Melody.
Hi there. This is fascinating. My husband said, he has COPD and he's blind, so he rings his bell when he wants me to listen to something. And he says, here's your glia. And I'm going, yeah, all right. About 5 years ago, my dad died of Alzheimer's, and it runs in our family. His brother had it, and his mom had it, and so anyway, I decided to be proactive, and I do some writing and pretty good researcher on the line. So I did a website called Happy Glia. Oh. Only it's not populated because then we had to take care of him and my mom, and now I have to take care of my husband, so I don't have time. But I'm so glad to hear that somebody's finally decided that glia do more than support. And my question is, has there been any research that this gentleman knows about? Is it Fields?
Mm-hmm.
As to what can be done by the person whose brain it is to strengthen these guys, because they're so very, very, very important.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call. You're talking about diet and exercise and lifestyle.
Anything possible that we can do or not do to strengthen these guys and support them in their work.
Right. Well, you've asked a number of interesting questions there, actually. And Alzheimer's disease, just to talk about that before your specific question, is, when Dr. Alzheimer described this disease, he described microglia all around these senile plaques, which are now understood to be diagnostic of this disease. So he knew they were there, but they were, again, just dismissed because neurons were like celebrities in a crowd, and people just didn't see the glia. But we now know that glia, microglia, remove these senile plaques, that astrocytes can generate plaques, and both of these types of glia can release oxidative molecules that cause oxidative damage. And also the glia are impaired by this beta amyloid, and so their normal important functions become impaired. So what can you do to strengthen glia? There's not enough known specifically, but I'll say this, that all the things you've probably, that you've heard about in the way of advice to improve the brain, the, you know, exercise has been shown to stimulate the birth of new neurons, for example, and the mechanisms are being worked out, that exercise causes a release of growth factors. BDNF is one, for example, and this will stimulate new neurons. Where are these growth factors coming from? They're coming from glia. So all of these methods that you're already familiar with probably work through glia, undoubtedly work through glia, both because glia release growth factors, they also release antioxidants, and they're constantly removing toxins and maintaining the healthy environment around neurons.
What do the glia look like in a brain that has been damaged by Alzheimer's?
Well, what you see is that these plaques, which are deposits of this peptide, are surrounded by microglia and actually penetrating into the glia. So the glia just surround it, attacking the plaques.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a link between damage to glia and mad cow disease.
Well, that's an example of... Yes, there is a link, and it's just another example that I give of how we overlooked the importance of glia and lost years and years of research. Again, all of the attention focused on neurons, and it wasn't for 25 years later before finally people began to look and say, gee, the prion, which causes mad cow disease, is inside glia. And so glia are spreading it all through the brain. It's just not an infection of neurons, so we'll never understand the disease if we leave out half the cells that are involved. And also, the glia are very important in the pathology, the damage that's caused as a result of that infection.
R. Douglas Fields is my guest. He's chief of the Section on Nervous System Development at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. His new book is called The Other Brain, From Dementia to Schizophrenia, How New Discoveries About the Brain Are Revolutionizing Medicine and Science. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You are welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is R. Douglas Fields. His latest book is called The Other Brain, From Dementia to Schizophrenia, How New Discoveries About the Brain Are Revolutionizing Medicine and Science. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So, Doug, we've spent most of this hour talking about the very good things that glia can do for us. They are also, however, the source of virtually all brain cancers. Why is that?
Well, that's right. Mature neurons don't divide, and cancer is a runaway cell division that forms a mass of tumors. So neurons are not in a position ever to become cancerous. Now, there's some exceptions in young children with immature neurons, but by and large, brain cancer is a disease of glia gone bad. Our understanding of glia is leading to new treatments for cancer. For example, the glioblastoma that Senator Kennedy suffered from. There are new treatments for that based on specific drugs that will target glia specifically and remove them one cell at a time instead of removing whole chunks of tissue.
Are we any closer to understanding about why sometimes sort of out of nowhere they start to go awry?
Well, we are, but it's a very complicated process. Cell division, as you can imagine, is one of the most complicated processes that needs to be highly controlled because you can't have cells dividing except when they're needed. You have to have them responding after to replace those that are lost through disease and aging, but that's tightly controlled. So usually cancer requires a number of different defects in a cell that will overcome all of these controls on cell division. But it's the glial cells that become aberrant and cancerous.
800-933-5372 is our number. We go next to Don in Dallas. Hello, Don.
Hi. I'm wondering about strokes.
Strokes?
Yeah, please.
Well, glia involved in strokes in many ways. First, they're the first responders after a stroke. So the astrocytes and the microglia respond to the damage that is caused by the loss of blood flow to the brain or the rupture of a blood vessel. And so they are central to recovery from stroke. And secondly, as I mentioned before, glia also control blood flow, which is fundamentally the process of that goes awry in a stroke.
You know, we spoke earlier based on an email about the relationship between glia and substance abuse. Talk for a minute about different kinds of mental illness and the implications for better understanding of glia in treating some of those.
I'm glad you asked that. That's a good question because, you know, I think it's easy to understand now based on what we understand that glia are doing is how they could be involved in Parkinson's and all these other neurological illnesses. But mental illness is a big surprise. And in recent years, new techniques like gene arrays that allow us to see what genes are changing in people who suffer mental illnesses like depression and schizophrenia has surprised us because we find these gene abnormalities are genes that are present in glia. Half of the genes that are abnormal in schizophrenia are genes in glia that make myelin, so that's a big surprise. Mm-hmm. But now we can sit back and look at this data and realize, well, mental illness and all our ideas of mental illness and our treatments for it, for example, SSRIs for depression, which are drugs that regulate the neurotransmitter levels to regulate mood and motivation, these neurotransmitter levels are normally being regulated by glia. So it makes sense that glia would be involved in the basic disorder and certainly will be involved in recovery.
So it may eventually turn out that dealing directly with the glia makes more sense than adding this chemical that deals with the...
Right, because that's what these cells normally do in the brain. And we are probably treating those cells with these drugs because they have some of the same receptors. You know, one of the fascinating things about this story is how we overlook half the brain for a century. How does that happen? And it's one of those great examples in science, and this reminds me of another one. There were clues all along. In fact, the first treatment for schizophrenia and depression was shock therapy, and shock therapy is still the most effective treatment for serious depression that can't be controlled with drugs. Nobody knows how it works. But the fundamental idea that sparked that was by Ladislav van Meduna in 1935, and he made an observation. He saw that in epileptic brains, there were more glia, more astrocytes. And in schizophrenia, there are fewer astrocytes. And we know this is true today. There's a lack of astrocytes in parts of the brain of schizophrenics, people with schizophrenia. So he just made the assumption that, well, it's just a problem of imbalance in glia. So he decided to induce a seizure in people with schizophrenia, and that would correct the imbalance. So it worked. Now, whether that's why it worked or not, who could say, but we now can see how a deficit in astrocytes certainly could lead to cognitive dysfunction, inability to control and balance neurotransmitters, and that electroshock therapy acting through glia could stimulate the genesis of new neurons. In fact, all the antidepressants used do stimulate the formation of new neurons, and that's another recent discovery. So they are acting through glia. And the glia also release growth factors because glia respond to neural signals, they respond to trauma, and increased excitability causes these astrocytes to begin releasing growth factors. So there are now many reasons we can see why glia would be involved in mental illnesses.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next to Patsy in Fort Worth. Hi, Patsy.
Hi. I have a question for him. What does all this do or have to do with autism? Could it help it or anything like that?
Yeah. Well, autism is a complex disorder, and it's understood to be a developmental disorder. I haven't talked about it in detail, but glia are very important in development of the brain. They actually form the scaffolding in the embryo controlling the migration of neurons and the development of the brain. So it's likely that glia will be involved in these kinds of developmental disorders. And it's probably just a problem in timing of migration and connection of neurons. Now, there have been changes in white matter in myelin in autism. And in that case, there's actually too much myelin. So definitely this is an area that needs to be further explored.
Are you still in your work, Doug, fighting a sort of bias from the scientific community against the study of glia, or has that pretty much fallen away now?
Well, you're right. That's one of the reasons that it was held back. There was a bias against it, but it has exploded in the last 4 years. When I first started writing this book, these developments were just happening. But and at that time, it was difficult to publish work in good journals, so together with other people, we started a new scientific journal, and this is the way, traditionally through science, that there is this paradigm shift, change in thinking about an area of science is to get like-minded people together. But anyway, to answer your question, no, there's been a revolution. It's just been an explosion in the last few years, which is why, by and large, the public hasn't heard about it. This information is not out yet. But now this work is published in all the best scientific journals, and it's clearly understood that glia are important, that we're on the cusp of a new understanding of how the brain works. It's a new dimension of brain function, information processing that we don't even have in any, never had in any of our theories before. So no, it's well accepted now and a vigorous area of research.
Let's speak next with Cindy in Arlington. Hello, Cindy.
Hi, I'm a certified athletic trainer, and I treat athletes with sport concussion, and I'm particularly interested in the role of the glial cell with sport concussion, either a single concussion or the multiple concussions. Obviously, this is reaching consumer awareness with recent cases of athletes who are suffering long-term problems from multiple concussions.
Interesting question. Well, the first cells to respond in a concussion are the astrocytes, and they respond by changing their biochemical makeup and their structure, an increase in a protein called GFAP. They release entirely different substances, so they really transform into another kind of a cell, or at least another state. Now, these cells are different from your native astrocytes, so one concussion now has changed these cells. When another concussion comes along, these cells are more likely now to respond differently from the original. So just much as I explained with chronic pain, astrocytes are releasing substances in response to the change in their structure as a result of the first injury that can lead to more severe injury with another mild assault on the brain.
Let's speak next with Barbara in Plano. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about the relationship of the glia to multiple sclerosis and maybe the relationship of that to mental disease.
Yeah. Well, multiple sclerosis is an example of a disease of glia. So we talked about how diseases of neurons can be controlled by glia, but here's a disease that is a glial disease because it's a disease caused by the body attacking its own glial cells that form the electrical insulation. Now your question about cognitive function is interesting. 40% of people with multiple sclerosis will experience a cognitive decline. And so this was a clue that there is cognitive consequences to the effects of glia controlling the information transmission through these fibers in our brain. Again, that was kind of dismissed. Obviously, if you break a connection, you're going to have a cognitive dysfunction, but we now realize that that was just too naive, too simplistic, because it's important, like an internet connection. The brain is like an internet in a way, that the transmission of information between different regions of the brain has to be highly coordinated and well-timed. And that means the speed of impulses between these sections of the brain has to be controlled. So it's not a simple matter of breaking or making a connection. If the timing is not right, then you'll have impaired cognitive function. We're talking about higher level cognitive functions, you know, and so that's been very that disease has provided a lot of insight into how glia can be involved in learning complex new behaviors.
What's so interesting about MS is that people who suffer from it very often will have periods where they're quite impaired, and then they'll get better for a while. How do you explain that?
Right, that's very classic of the disorder, and that's because glial cells can divide, and they are constantly in a battle to protect our brain our whole life. They are fighting infection, and they are reproducing and repairing the brain constantly. So People will have an attack on the insulation. They'll lose function, and then the oligodendrocytes will begin to reform from stem-like cells and begin to repair the lesion and re-insulate these fibers, and now you have restored function. But in chronic MS, there's this constant attack that eventually overwhelms the efforts of glia to repair the brain.
We can go very quickly to one final call from Stacy in Dallas. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. My question is, my husband's grandmother passed away of Creutzfeldt-Jakob, and excuse me if I didn't pronounce it correctly, and there's not much known about the disease, and I heard you talking about the brain cells and glia, and if this disease has anything to do with that and or recommendations as far as, you know, as far as my kids, what they need to be aware of with this.
Right. Well, that's a hereditary disease that involves a prion protein and a mutation in this protein that makes it more likely to change form into a pathological form. So it's related to mad cow disease, as you know. And I have a little bit of this in the book. Glia are involved in that glia also have prion proteins. We actually don't know what the prion proteins do. When they become misfolded, this leads to severe disease.
Are there things, obviously there's a lot more to learn, but I wonder, Doug, if there are particular mysteries about glia and how they work and how they act in the brain that are still really particularly baffling to you?
Well, that's the exciting, being on the cusp of this new understanding of the brain, a new dimension of information processing. Information flowing through a part of the brain that's not neuronal, it's not electric. How does it work? What does this new dimension of brain function do to explain how the mind works? How plastic are glia? Do glia learn? We know they're entirely different from neurons, so we have to think differently. One astrocyte can control 100,000 synapses. Neurons communicate like telephones and telephone lines serially, but glia broadcasts their signals. So glia are having this big overriding influence on the brain that really is something entirely new to information processing, our whole ideas of how the brain work. The other thing I should say is glia communicate slowly, so glia are not involved in these rapid reflex activities where neurons excel, and that's why neurons use electricity. But so much of what our brain does takes a long time. It takes a long time to learn to play the guitar. And those kinds of things, sleep, mood, cycles through life, are the kinds of things, brain functions, where we think glia are uniquely suited to maybe explain some of the mysteries of how the mind works.
R. Douglas Fields is chief of the Section on Nervous System Development at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. The new book is called The Other Brain. Doug, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.